Some of you may not know exactly what the Commissioner of Education does. Commissioner Holland keeps trying to find out what that is. But officially, what his role would be on an organizational chart is that he's my boss, he's President Oak's boss at BYU, and the people who administer the seminaries and institutes also report to him. President Hal Eyring, who was the president of RICS for several years, until just recently, as you know, is the deputy commissioner and also reports to Commissioner Holland. He assists with the seminaries and institutes and church schools all over the world. And Commissioner Holland reports to the Board of Trustees of the educational system. The president of that board is President Kimball, and his counselors work with him there. And so they look to him, and he's the kind of the focal point. They look at him this way, and we all look at him this way, and he's supposed to understand everything that everybody needs from the greatest to the least throughout the church. And to his great eternal credit, he does understand all that. What a blessing it is that a man of his capacities would be the Commissioner of Education. The kids love him. The brethren love him. He understands us. He was a great student. He was a great teacher. And he's a fine leader. It's a real treat to have him and his wife here today.
My thanks to President Hafen for that generous introduction. I saw the blank looks on your faces, which I would have had too, were I sitting out there, for all of that kindness. It reminds me, your reaction and mine reminds me of a story I would have told a couple of you, but it's the story of the young man from southern Idaho who found himself in World War II, drafted and sent against his wishes into the European campaign, and he finds himself in Great Britain in the middle of World War II, and he hates it, hates everything about it, hates the rain, hates the food, hates the fatigues, hates the sea rations, hates the army, hates everything, wants to be home, thinks somebody else is driving his girl to the junior prom, and he's more depressed than if he were on a mission. And he's just frustrated about it, and sees a phone number there by the written on the wall, in emergency call, you know, so he's in an emergency, and he calls and gets somebody under, and he says, I hate all of this. I hate the food, and I hate the rain, I hate the people, I hate the war, I hate the trenches, I hate all of it. Just on and on and on. Sort of a dignified long pause at the end of his speech before somebody on the other end says, soldier, do you know who this is? And he says, no, I don't. Another sort of pause. And he said, well, you have, in your moment of frenzy, called Supreme Allied Headquarters. This is General Dwight D. Eisenhower speaking. And there's another little pause. And then the soldier says, well, do you know who this is? And the general says, no, as a matter of fact, I don't. And he said, well, thank the Lord for that. And hung up. I don't expect you to just come right out of your seats with the announcement of my visit here. That's the visit that I make is much more for my sake than for yours. And I'm grateful for the chance to be with you anytime I can, and to be with your president and the administration and the faculty and staff. But most of all, I'm always most grateful to be with you. I would like to talk to you for just a minute about what I think you've done to President Hafen. I'm paid to be worried about this. I'm not his boss. That's the wrong kind of word. He shoots bullets, and I sit down there making them. I call up and I say, how many bullets do you want? And he puts in an order. But you've done something to him. I don't know whether the faculty's done it or the student body, but I've known him for a long, long time, and he's always been a sweet, disciplined, pleasant man. He looks right and he acts right, and so the brethren said he's just a man for the presidency of Ricks College. And then we send him up here, and I get the scroll. I get the scroll every week, and I open and I see him out on a basketball floor and sort of. It's sort of an old-time uniform. It's one of those old 1890 bathing suits, but he's out there, black high-top sneakers, but, you know, dribbling the ball and bouncing around. I see a picture of him honorary member of the wrestling team. This is the president that I've known all these years. Sweet and disciplined and dignified. A little basketball here, a little wrestling there. We had a meeting in his office this morning. On the table, not a vase of flowers, not fresh fruit plucked from the vines of Madison County. No, in the middle of the table was a shot put. Just sitting there, and he said he's been working out, a couple of dents in the walls, one broken window. He's been chucking this thing around, but he's still there. He's got a white shirt on and a suit, and he's looking for all the world like the man we sent here. I checked with Shirley and Iris out in the front office, and they said every now and again, they look through the crack in the door, and he's turning sort of a green, and the sides of his pants are splitting, and his t-shirt ripped right up the back. And through some process that nobody yet has identified, where it says President Bruce Hafen, it's immediately transferred to President David Banner. And then that goes. It passes. If any of you want to talk to me about that personally, I'll be in a phone booth right after this. Right after this devotional. And I will be needing to make a report in Salt Lake. I want to be semi-serious for a moment, which is the best I can do. Everybody I know is mad at the 1970s. One commentator recently said, if I owned the 1970s, I would sell them. A year too early, but not a moment too soon. I assumed that with 1 year remaining in the contract, that 1979 would be traded to the 1980s for 6 months and a fixed sum of some later year. The problems, plural, go on and on and on. The sort of lamentation about all that's happened economically and socially and politically, and you watch the news and read the newspapers and you know all of those problems. And I say, how can that be? What can be wrong with a decade that has given you not only Shake and Bake, but Mork and Mindy? And clones and frozen yogurt and R2-D2. And King Kong, the big fellow with the raccoon coat. That kind of decade, obviously, can't be all bad. I encourage you, as you face the future, to not become what Elder Gordon B. Hinckley once called pickle suckers. Those schooled in the venom and invective of sort of saline views of life. I hope that you can, as encouraging and as faithfully and as devoutly as you need to be, I hope you can face the future with the kind of eye that Latter-day Saints have always faced the future. There weren't, kids, let me reassure you, there weren't any good old days. Somebody in the White House recently, as they sat down to review the Middle East, Iran, Taiwan, inflation, public transportation, and national health in that order, as they sat down to that meeting, said, ah, for the benign 1960s. Benign 1960s. I was in the benign 1960s, and they weren't benign. They were years when cities were gutted, when a president of this country was murdered in the streets, when college campuses literally became battlegrounds, a campus on which I resided and from which I took my wife and children literally into the country 10 miles to stay at a friend's house, just in case what appeared to happen would happen. There weren't any benign 1960s. And Mr. Fonzarelli notwithstanding, there weren't any benign 1950s or 40s or 30s or 20s. So at the same moment that I encourage you to be hopeful and positive and enthusiastic, I do want to express one concern. It's a concern expressed best, I suppose, in a magazine I saw recently on a bookstand. I don't know whether it's a magazine you have in Rexburg or not, but it is called simply Self. Got it? From life and look to people and us, we have now come to self. And if I have a concern for your world, and it is of necessity my world, and more than that, I guess our children's world, your children and mine, if I have a concern, it may be suggested in that title. May I read you something? My concern is the threat of a moral vision which seems to steadily decrease until it may finally come down only to self. It is one life wide and one life deep, and the devil take the hindmost. The threat I fear is the threat of self-centeredness gone amok, of psychic insistence upon everyone doing his own thing, of everyone getting in touch with himself at the expense of getting in touch with anyone else. It is the threat of a culture which has in some ways carried accentuated individualism to the extreme and now has the pursuit of happiness standing paralyzed in front of a mirror, pleading, "Who's the fairest of them all?" We live in a time in which there has been almost transcendent self-attention, where the conquest of nature and the search for new frontiers has given way to neo-narcissism, that greatest of all tasks in the 70s, self-realization. In a world where it's all hanging out, where we've immersed ourselves in ourselves, where intimacy has gone public and four-letter words batter our ears, in a quest for instant gratification and purely personal views of the world, we run the risk of profoundly violating the two great commandments on which all others depend. We may come to find neither love of God nor of neighbor, but only love of ourselves. And should that ever be so, then as Pogo Possum would say, we have found the enemy and he is us. I don't know whether you care at all about what life... Well, you do care. That's not appropriate to say. You care. I guess what I'm suggesting is I don't know whether you think about what your children's life is going to be. I did not. I confess when I sat in your seat, I hardly thought about my life 10 years from now, let alone my children's 20 or 30 from now. But I invite you to do so and to consider the possibilities and the damages of a world that may, in fact, be that preoccupied with self-centeredness or selfishness or my own life or do my own thing at the expense of what it takes for us to live together. Because it becomes theological. It is not just what you do at Rick's College, and it isn't just what you do in your apartment or what you do in your branch or what you do in the local school club. The implications go on and on and on, and it's one thing to talk about Rexburg, but it's only slightly more to talk about the United States, and it's only just a leap, I suppose, to talk about a Middle East crisis that's as recent as this morning's newspaper and news. And finally, theology. O God, put away justice and truth, for we cannot understand them and we do not want them. Leave thy heavens and come down to our earth. Become our uncle. Look after baby. Amuse grandfather. Escort madam to the opera. Help Willie with his homework. Introduce Muriel to a handsome naval officer. Be interesting and weak like us. And then we will love you as we already love ourselves. That's why I say it's theological. Political problems, economic problems, social problems, cultural problems, academic problems, apartment problems, Rick's and Rexburg problems, Ryrie and Roberts and Rupert problems, I've got to avoid that. I start to get into that and then I'm in real trouble. But those problems are theological. You push them far enough and ask enough about them and pursue them to the logical extension, and it is a statement about what our relationship is with God and what these commandments mean. Loving God, loving other people, loving ourselves in the right way, not loving ourselves in the wrong way, not loving other people in the wrong way. And while that isn't easy to say at a Camp David summit or in some sort of ambassadorial hopping between Cairo and Jerusalem, I'm just suggesting that it's closer to home than that, that you don't have to go to Cairo to solve at least some portion of the world's problems. My guess is you just need to go to the dorm or to the branch or the ward now, or to class, or home. And that can be your roommate's home, or your parents' home, or your own home as you create it. And if I have a concern, if we care enough, we can deal with inflation, we can deal with world wars, we can deal with energy crises. I believe in that consummate and inconquerable spirit that is a child of God. And that's all of us. And if we care and if we want, we can pursue that. The one great concern I have about you and about me and about our time is some sort of incessant insistence on doing our own thing, on getting in touch with ourselves, as it suggested, rather than getting in touch with somebody else, let alone getting in touch with God. May I quote from one of the great minds of modern life, President Bruce C. Hafen. I'm quoting from his superb article in The Ensign, which if you haven't read, you must, of December of last year. He said, this chaos, it's the kind of chaos, though not specifically, but it's the kind of chaos to which I've referred, pandemonium socially and economically and politically and every other way, and it goes on. What I'm trying to suggest is it is not just the 1970s. It isn't just a lamentation about this year as opposed to any other year. Some way, somehow, sometime, until we're better than we are and more religious and righteous and faithful and devoted than we are, until the gospel of Jesus Christ can get to more places and into more hearts than it is now in, it'll always be a problem. That to that kind of chaos, and about that kind of chaos, as it's seen in the 1970s, President Hafen says, that part of this is due to, quote, the almost endless talk about personal liberty and self-fulfillment. It is in the air. There are rights movements everywhere. Can I continue that quote from that same issue of the Ensign? President Hafen says, this is why I say it matters to you today, in your dorm, in your apartment, in your ward. It gets as real as marriage and things like that, and there's nothing more real on the Rexburg campus than that. May I quote about those rights, that self-fulfillment, not understanding the depth of commitment made in a marriage, and perhaps influenced by seductive talk about the rights to self-fulfillment, many in today's world who experience marital difficulties simply leave the scene of conflict by either literally or figuratively divorcing themselves from the person they view as the source of their frustration. Many of these in time will marry another person or move to a new apartment, only to find that another set of conflicts and frustrations exist. Once again, they may leave that scene of that conflict, somehow believing that they're entitled to live without the inconvenience of dealing with points of view different from their own. Thus, they may never experience what it is to understand a situation from the perspective of another person or subordinate their views to the needs of another. As a result, they deprive themselves of the experiences necessary to permit the discovery of the meaning of love. Close quote. They deprive themselves of the experience necessary to discover the meaning of love. Now, I don't know what solves political problems. I don't know what solves economic and social and cultural and academic problems. But my guess is it has something to do with the experience necessary to develop the meaning of love. For other people, for each other, for parents, for our children yet unborn, for ourselves in the right way and hopefully not the wrong way. In that same vein, two great sociologists writing out of a major university in the East say almost literally the same thing. Is it possible, say Mr. and Mrs. Glasser, Dr. and Dr. Glasser, is it possible that more and more young people and some older ones, faculty, also face a marital relationship expecting instant gratification for which no effort on their part is required? Can we hypothesize, they say, that society's emphasis on individualism is so great that marriage is not seen as a partnership, but another place to compete for the gratification of personal needs? Can it be suggested that family life is no longer seen as a cooperative venture among parents and children who have responsibilities to each other, but simply as one more place where each grabs what he can without endangering future rewards. How do you get along in your apartments? Why am I getting that sort of ripple effect through the audience? How do you get along on dates? How do you get along with your own parents? Why is that getting more of a response? How do you get along with your little brothers and sisters? Do you think it will be so different when you're married? Do you think that in some majestic, monumental, metaphysical way, a wand will be waved and the problems and challenges of daily life, hourly life, financial and emotional and social and academic and professional and private, do you think those will all slip away into never, never land through the heart carved at the end of the gym for the sweetheart's ball? It will not go away. It does not go away in a marriage. It doesn't go away in a political conflict. It doesn't slip out the door in inflationary, economic, difficult times. Those are some of the realities of life for which I assume we're sent here, and about which President Hafen says we need to learn the essence of love. Love for who God is, love for what the commandments are, love for why things work well when we're obedient and why they don't work well when we're not, why we're happier when we're free from sin and unhappy as all get out when we're not, why, for as many implications as those need to have for you in this life, in this hour, on this campus, I hope you're willing to make. It does not seem to me fair of you, in terms of your own personal contribution in this world, in terms of your own willingness to say there are others on this planet besides me, it does not seem to me, to you, or about you, to be fair, to say all the problems are in Peking, or Taiwan, or New York, or Jerusalem. You know, and I know, that they're not. There are a few problems, challenges, frustrations, heartaches, tears, and triumphs in Rexburg. And you have a chance to do something about it. Would you allow me to tell a story? It is the children of Israel wandering in the desert, passing the same pork and bean can about every 36 months and wondering how they're going to get out of there. And, you know, is there no end to these sand dunes? A little of this goes a long way. And they send Moses up to the top of the hill to see if he can converse with anybody up there. And Moses ascends, taking Joshua and leaving him halfway up the hill. And Moses goes to face the Lord and try to obtain whatever priesthood or principles or covenants or commandments or tablets or directions or roadmaps that it takes to get out of here. Now, they're trying to get out of Egypt. The Lord's trying to get Egypt out of them. That's part of the dynamic of having to undo 400 years in an apostate, difficult, foreign world for these children of Israel. So, Moses goes up the hill and faces God, hearing the word of the Lord, seeing the finger writes on these tablets. He's there stunned for day after day after day. It is a long experience, as you know. And he's getting the very direction that he went there to get. He is getting the instruction, the covenants and the principles and the commandments and the promises about how to get home. If you want to get home, Moses, this is what you do. And some of it's going to be written on these little tablets. But I want to talk to you about it for quite a little while. And let's get one thing straight. Before we start writing, let's just understand this. Before I can talk to you about chastity and loving your parents and a lot of other things that matter in Rexburg, we've got to get one thing straight. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Now, I want to get on to those other subjects, but I can't say anything about that until you get that through the head of these little people down there. That's part of the reason you're not home now. That's part of the reason you do keep seeing that same pork and bean can. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Get rid of those gold calves. Try to forget the Pharaoh. All that you went through down there in that world is not going to exist now when we go home to a land flowing with milk and honey and in my covenant promise. So write it down. And in fact, here's a second one, just in case anybody forgets. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Now, I've only got 10 commandments and I've given you 2. I've used up 20% of my tablets. A fifth of the space available to us is gone, but it's worth it. None of this other stuff's going to matter unless you understand that. So here's Moses, all in a tizzy, getting all of this down and ready to pack his tablets down the hill and get these people home. And guess what's going on down at the bottom of the hill? They think he's been gone too long. They think he went over the top of the hill and grabbed a sack lunch at the bottom and went on somewhere. He's probably out backstroking the Mediterranean. And they're concerned, and they say to Aaron, who was left in charge, "Look, he's gone. You better get us out of here." I'll read what they said. "Up to Aaron, make us gods for which shall go before us. For this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him." That's sort of Elizabethan 17th century language. It's a little hard to understand, but that's what it says. Moses is taken off. We don't know what's happened to him. You better whip us out a gold calf. We've got to get out of here. And we're used to relying on gold calves. Thus the conversation at the top of the hill. Okay? Dramatic case in point. Well, Aaron, what does he do? What should he do? Well, he says, "Bring me the earrings and the bracelets and the necklace that your boyfriend gave you while he's on his mission. And I will work with them and we'll get this calf." He received them at their hand, these gold elements, he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool. After he made a molten calf and said, "These be thy gods, O Israel." And they had a great party. They had one of the all-time great parties. It was heard from Dan to Beersheba. In fact, Joshua hears it halfway up the hill and he thinks there's a war on. He thinks the Babylonians have swept down in some sort of reverse encounter. And he, the great military man that he is, he wants to thunder down and get his slingshot. Moses, at the top of the hill, is getting a little more direct information. The Lord says, "Moses, we've got a problem. Why don't we just cut this conversation short here for a minute, because you remember the gold calves we were just talking about?" And so Moses reluctantly says, "Okay, I'll be back. Let me lug these tablets down the hill and see if they do any good." But as he gets down the hill and Joshua says, "Look, the battle's half over. We should have been there. Our guys are losing." And Moses says, "Yeah, they're losing all right. But it isn't any battle." What he literally says is, "It is not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is it the voice of them that cry for being overcome." That is not victor or vanquished you hear down there. It is the noise of them that sing. The noise of them that sing. That's like I sing. That's sort of show me the way to go home. The worst, you know, it's ever been sung. They're just having the kind of party that isn't appropriate on the Ricks College campus. And Moses is heartbroken about it. I guess in a lot of ways, he would wish it were the Babylonians. You could do something about that. But what do you do about this crowd? Well, you know what happens. He comes down the mountain brokenhearted and breaks the tablets. And says, "I will not, I cannot, I won't bring to you what I felt in the presence of the Lord. I'm simply going to take this figurative roadmap and tear it up, and we've got to straighten a few things out." Breaks the tablets, destroys the gold calf, pours it in the water, makes them drink of it, a kind of symbolism, I suppose, involved there, and then there's a fist fight. And he says, "Let's get a couple of things straight here. Who really wants to go home? Who believes in why we are going home?" And there's a little debate about the God of Israel, and 3,000 people lose their lives. And then at that point, with all of that dust settling, he walks up to Aaron. "Moses said unto Aaron, What did this people unto thee, that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them?" What'd they do, brother? Literally, his own brother. What'd they do? Did they tell your kids they couldn't go to seminary? You know, did he poke bamboo sticks under your fingernails, and did the Vikings lose a game? What possibly could have happened to so destroy your morale that you would have done this? Here's Aaron's answer. "Let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people. They're set on mischief. This is a lousy crowd. You knew it. You and I are the only straight arrows around here. We ought to get this thing straight and leave town." Said, "You know, you leave an unruly batch like this with me, they start messing around, I can't control them. You know, there's not a duty to God winner in the crowd. I want to go home." You know. And here's his actual account of, you'll be able to separate, won't you, the sort of Holland commentary from the actual scripture, I'm sure. "They said unto me," I am now quoting, "They said unto me, Aaron, make us gods, which shall go before us. For this Moses, the man which brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him." Now, that is literally what they said. That is an exact quote of what they said. Fair enough, Aaron. But now here's his little postscript. And I said unto them, this is the part that's new, whosoever hath any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it in the fire, and there came out this calf. I am reading the actual record. I have to make that distinction between what I'm contributing and what the book is. I am reading from the 32nd chapter of Exodus. I cast it into the fire, and there came out this calf. Leaped right out at me. I just sort of dumped this gold in there, and straight out of that fire came this calf, moving for all he was worth. Now, I beg your pardon, please. How did that calf come out of there? Aaron received them, these gold pieces, at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool. He spent 6 weekends with a big Black and Decker up at the shop working on this thing. And he has the sort of audacity to stand up to Moses and say, well, I sort of dumped this stuff and I was nearly run down by this calf coming right out of this fire. I've tried that and so have you. I've done that. I still do it a little. My wife says, I'm not as flagrant in it. I'm a little more discreet, but I used to do it a lot. My mother is a great cook, and my wife has continued that tradition, and I'm sort of a living example and display to that end. I sleep with 2 chairs on each side of my bed to hold my cheeks up, so I don't get stretch marks on my temples up here. But my mother used to bake cookies. And she'd say on her way to Relief Society, now, little sweetheart, lambykins, poochie poo, don't eat those cookies until I get home. We're going to have a little dinner, you know, sort of all the vitamins and the 5 basic groups and all of that. Or is it 7? And then we will have cookies. I didn't care about any groups, 5, 7, or 20. I wanted cookies. So I say, okay, Mom, gotcha. Right on, Mom. Go do your own thing, Mom. As she heads off to teach her Relief Society class. And to show how indiscreet, I suppose I was, unwise, that's why I'm wiser in this day and age, I didn't even let her get out of the driveway. Anybody would have at least followed her down to the street corner and seen her turn the corner, not me. No, there I am, as she comes back in having forgotten the keys to the car. That's how much time I give her. Having forgotten the keys to the car, she comes back in and I'm there. Lid off the jar, both hands stuffed. Great heaping mounds of cookies in both hands. And she, like Moses, wise and sensitive and careful, says, what happened? You know, a little leadership tip there about how you approach a problem. I guess you give people enough rope to hang themselves. I don't know. But foolish, like Aaron, I said something about as smart as a calf running out of the fire. Just walking by and the old cookies jumped out. And you know, you see that is not going anywhere. She's not buying that. And so you just go deeper. Then you say something stupid like, well, you told me if I ever touched them not to put them back. And it's sort of like quicksand. Every movement you're about up to here. And that's okay for an 8-year-old. But it isn't okay for an 18-year-old. Not really. And it isn't okay for an 80-year-old, which Aaron and I are now. At some point, we really sort of need to grow up. What I'm really saying is, Aaron's inclination here is to say, look, Moses, this is everybody's problem but mine. I haven't got a problem in the place. Those people out there, you know them. You know these people, Moses. They're lousy bounders. You know, we've never been able to get a bandolo on one of them. You know how other problems are, and gee, aren't things tough in Jerusalem today, and hope things are settled in Peking. But don't ask me about the dorm on the Ricks College campus. I haven't got a problem in this world. Occasionally a calf runs out at me, but it's not my fault. Well, some of us are fashioning calves in the living room of our dorms, I promise you, and our wards, and our homes, and our families, and our classes. Compare that, will you, with Moses' response. Now he has to go. He told the Lord he'd be back, and he has to be back. And he says, you have sinned a great sin, and I will go up unto the Lord, and peradventure I will make an atonement for your sin. Moses returned unto the Lord and said, Oh, this people have sinned a great sin. How can he bear it? How can he do it? The very speech he was given, the very thing that he's there getting written with the finger of the Lord on these tablets, and he taking quick notes on a 3x5 card so that he doesn't remember to give the speech, the very message he's had about gods of gold, graven images, no other representation of deity before us, and he goes down and here's this wild party around a gold calf. And he comes back to face the Lord and said, they've sinned a great sin. They have made them gods of gold. And my guess is that absolutely chokes in his throat. I don't know that he can get that out very well. Now, if thou wilt forgive their sin, and he's on the verge of a request, Lord, can you turn a blind eye one more time? You know, give us one more shot at that pork and bean can. I know we can get out of here. But he can't even bring himself to ask it. The sentence stops. There's a hyphen in the print. And he can't continue the question. He cannot bring himself to ask for that favor. And he changes his course. He said, Lord, if you cannot, if not, he's really so embarrassed and so disappointed, and I think literally so heartbroken, that he can't even bring himself to say, Lord, once more, can we try once more? Compared to what he felt and what he saw, what he heard from God and what he heard from these sings and songs and singers of a sort of selfishness. You know, it's anybody's problem but mine here. He can't even go on with the question and shifts and says, if not, Lord, if you cannot forgive them, blot me, I pray thee, out of the book which thou hast written. The one man, I think the one man who could go up there and say, Lord, I've had it. I'm up to here with those guys. My own brother included. There isn't one in the crowd that I can depend on any given Sunday to show up and perform any priesthood tasks. The home teaching isn't done. No visiting teaching. No kindness. No charity. Big gold calves in every living room. I've had it. Now he's the one man in the room, collectively, figuratively speaking, who could have said that. He's the one man that was not guilty of the transgression. But what does he say? Lord, if somebody has to pay, could it possibly be me? Blot me, I pray thee, out of the book which thou hast written. They've got to go home. I know they've got problems. I know they're not all they should be, and I know they're not keeping the commandments. At least not as many of them as they should be. But Lord, whatever else they are, they're my people. And Aaron, big grown kid, should know better, a high priest in the church, former bishop and stake president and mission president. I know we should know better. But Lord, he's my brother. And if somebody has to stay, if somebody has to mill through these sand dunes, could it possibly in any way be me? And could you find it in your heart of hearts to let them go home? What makes a man or a woman do that? What makes you kind when you haven't been kindly dealt with? What makes you patient when other people are impatient with you? Why should you wash the dishes when you've washed them and washed them and washed them? Why should you study for an exam when it doesn't look like anybody else isn't there doing about as well? Why should you turn out for practice week after week after week and maybe not get to play? Why should you decorate the gym or the recreation hall or the apartment or dust or sweep or clean or pray? When in the great scheme of things, as you watch it week after week, it may not seem to make a heck of a lot of difference to a lot of other people. I don't know why, except that there is something gospel-oriented and eternally grounded in that response. Lord, if somebody has to pay, could it possibly be me? Could I be the one? As opposed to a response that says, look, if there are problems around here, I want you to get it straight, Lord, and roommates, and President Hafen, and Bishop, and anybody. It's not my problem. And wife, and husband, and child. Boy, if there are problems in this family, it's not me. I have run into a calf or two, but I didn't create that thing. Well, Moses didn't either. And he could have said, get me out of here. I do want to pick up a sack lunch and be gone by noon tomorrow. I've had it. I've had it with the apartment. I've had it with the ward. I've had it with the world. I've had it with Sadat and Begin. I've had it with everybody. But what you do is you stick around and eat your lunch on the spot and go back to work. And you pray a little more and study a little harder and serve a little more kindly and react a little more patiently. And you fly the flag. That's what you do. You fly the flag. You plant your feet and you say, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but right here on my little half acre, you will find the Zion of heaven and earth, my little city of Enoch, right here. And if it's this apartment or this bedroom or this role in the Relief Society or the Elders' Quorum, I can't solve all the world's problems. I can't even solve most of them. But I can at least stand up and be counted and say, Lord, don't let me off the hook. I'm ready to go back in, Coach. Send me. And it may not even be your problem. That's the irony. I'm trying to suggest that there are lots of problems to go around for everybody. But in this case, in this grievance, in this difficulty or disappointment or heartache, it may not be your problem. At least it may not be your fault. But if you're willing to say, Lord, if somebody's got to broaden their back and strengthen their shoulders, let it be me. Because whatever else she is, she's my sister. And whatever else they are, they're my brothers and ward members and Latter-day Saint colleagues and non-member friends and world leaders. I'll do my little part, and I don't want to get off the hook. At this moment, I choose, Lord, not to do my own thing. But I'll do somebody else's thing. Yours, his, theirs, the church's, the gospel's, the truth. And while I'm doing that, I will find that indeed somehow eternally, evermore, faithfully, that comes to be our thing. And we learn something about what it means to live together in love and to show the kind of discipline, the kind of real freedom and real rights, the only kind of which I know that are promised in the gospel of Jesus Christ. May I close with a little article that my daughter wrote for her school essay contest. She was asked to write what love is. That was the title under which she was to write, and she didn't have an answer. She didn't know what to put. And she struggled and stewed and wandered around the house and beat on the wall and put her head under the covers and went day after day and couldn't decide how to describe what she thought love was. And then one day it all came together in our home. She sat down and wrote the essay and won the little contest in the school and then in the district and then in the state, and it finally got published in the Children's Friend. Could I read it to you, misspelling and all? What Love Is by Mary Holland. I was practicing the piano and it made me cry because it was bad. Then I decided to practice ballet and it made me cry more. It was bad too. So then I decided to draw a picture because I knew I could do that good, but it was horrid. Of course, it made me cry. Then my little brother, 3 years old, came up and I said, Oh, Duffy, what can I be? I can't be a piano player or an artist or a ballet girl. Oh, what can I be? A little drama in there. My little brother, 3 years old, came up to me and whispered, Mary, you can be my sister. And that is something everybody can be. A sister, a brother, a friend, and I think that is what love is. Signed, Mary Holland. I don't know whether you're disappointed in people or possibilities or programs or principles or politics. I don't know whether so much that you hope for or count on for a moment seems to be beyond your grasp. I don't know what kind of, individually, I don't know what kind of challenges you face, but I can guess at them. We've all faced them. There weren't ever any good old times. If at that moment you see the chance, would you please take it? Knowing full well that everybody in this room and everybody in that apartment and everybody in that ward and everybody on this campus is feeling some of that same kind of emotion. When it doesn't look like they can play the piano or practice ballet or draw a picture, will you take the chance as often as God gives you the ability to see it, will you take the chance to walk up and say, Susie or Sammy or Janie or Johnny, maybe the piano and the ballet and the pictures aren't going well, maybe school and dates and hopes and dreams aren't going well, but there's one thing you can be. One thing forever and ever and ever you can be. You can be my sister. Or you can be my brother. Or you can be my friend, and that is what I think love is. Signed, Mary Holland. God bless you as you pursue happiness, one of the inalienable rights according to our founding fathers, and scripturally true from Holy Writ, as you pursue happiness. God bless you to sense your obligations to provide that for someone else in a fully mature, responsive, broad-shouldered, straight-backed way where you ask for your part of the burden and your piece of the task to bring to pass the peace and the happiness and the hope that this world dreams of and that you dream of and that I dream of and that with God's help we're able to have. I ask in the name of Jesus Christ, amen.